You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, we are joined once again by expert Dr. Krishna McGovern. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I've said many a time that it feels strange saying good afternoon, but not so much today. It's been sunny all day and it's been...
Yeah, it's been great today.
Yeah, I've been loving the weather over the recent few days. Always something to talk about as well. Classic Auckland weather. Don't know when it's going to switch up on it, so enjoy it while it lasts.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Sorry, we've got lots of science to get through, so... Yeah, let's focus on that with pandas, especially this first one here, which was crazy to me, right? What's going on with pandas?
Right, so, okay, pandas. We all know pandas, one of the most famous animals in the world, I would think. And it's for giant pandas, it's all about the bamboo. Bamboo, bamboo, bamboo. That's all they kind of eat.
Classically, right?
Yeah.
Pandas, you think about them.
Yeah, you think pandas, you think bamboo. Like they're eating the shoots, the leaves, the stems. And it's really... weird if you think about it, because their digestive system is for a carnivore. They're part of a biological order called Carnivora, and that basically means that their digestive system is ideal for being carnivorous, eating meat. But
interesting.
Instead, they're herbivores.
Yeah, and I assume bamboo is not very nutritious, right?
Yeah, no, I can't imagine it would take a lot to digest, and it's they refer to it as a hard plant, which makes sense, right?
Yeah,
if you think about bamboo. It's a bit of a mystery as to why
a panda's not eating meat.
Why just one real plant? It's not even it's a very varied plant diet.
Bamboo. Just one thing. Seems very samey as well. I couldn't eat bamboo all the time.
No, I think I'd get a bit bored.
Mm.
Don't mind, a little bit of bamboo shoots in the stir fry, but... not all the time.
But the pandas of old, apparently...
yeah, a little bit different. So, there's a site in southern Germany called, and excuse the pronunciation here, Hammerschmid site in, as I said, southern Germany, and they've found this fossil, and it turns out there are a few examples of this, fossils of this animal around Europe, it turns out. It seems like maybe the... panda started off in Europe and has migrated across to China in past times.
Very interesting.
And again, excuse the pronunciation. So this panda ancestor is called Cryptorchidus beatrix. So I'm just going to call it Beatrix from here on, because I'm pretty sure I made a real hash of that
first
name.
Oh, not to worry, I'm sure.
So it lived about 11 million years ago. It was slightly smaller than the giant pandas we know now.
Yeah.
But they say it could still have been about 100 kilos. So I had to go look up what a adult giant panda would weigh.
Yeah.
And that's 100 to 115 kilos.
So pretty heavy.
Pretty heavy.
I've never seen a panda in person, but I assume they're quite big.
Yeah. No, so I was lucky enough years ago when I was a kid, they actually had to come to the Auckland Zoo. So that's one of the things I remember from primary school, was being able to go see the pandas.
Yeah.
And so they are big.
Mm.
But you're also going, that's a lot of bamboo.
Yeah. Right? to maintain such a big animal? Yeah.
So with this fossil, what they do when they look at fossils and they're trying to determine diet is often if they've got some teeth, they're going to look at the teeth, right? Because that's what we're using to chew. And so what they've done in this case with this fossil is they've compared the teeth to other bear species, so like polar bears, brown bears, obviously pandas, and also some of the extinct ancestors of pandas as well. And basically what you're doing is you're doing a macro and a micro analysis of the teeth. So by macro, what I mean is you're looking at the shape of the teeth. So if you think of our teeth, humans are a good example of this, right? Because we've got those... incisors, which are the front ones, which are like blades.
Very good for cutting.
Right? They're good for cutting. Then you've kind of got your pointy canines, and then you've got your molars, which have got that flatter surface, which they're the ones that you chew
with.
Great
for chewing. Mm.
So you can kind of already see where the
got
shape...
got that teeth diversity.
It matters, right? So what they've done is they've looked at kind of the shape of these teeth, and then they've done the micro analysis, which is when you're now looking at the scratches and the pits on the teeth.
Mm.
And you're comparing this to these other bears, and you're seeing what are their teeth shape, what are their scratches in the pits like on theirs. And so what they've found is that this Beatrix was an omnivore, ate plants and meat. So it wasn't just a meat eater like a polar bear.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just a plant eater like the modern giant panda.
Yeah.
It was more like a brown bear, which eats a bit of both.
Berries, fish, that sort of thing. Yeah. Classic brown bear diet.
They were able to say, because they're with the microanalysis, they were with the scratches and the pits they said, saw, they were like, you know, we do know it must have been eating some meat, and like, because there was a bit of damage that they would say was probably from bone.
Right.
And so what this means is that it was probably quite late in the panda's evolution, so recent history, that it's kind of changed to this diet. So we still don't know why.
Yeah,
it's
not,
all about
no
the bamboo.
Idea what's going on with their bamboo.
Yeah.
Yeah, I assume they eat for quite a lot of the day,
they
right?
Must,
yeah.
It must be like koalas, I think, eat for a lot of the day.
That was the comparison I was thinking of in my mind. Yeah.
But
strange.
The other thing that was quite cool about this, because it with this study, which kind of led me on to reading more about this site, Hammerschmidt, in that this site is really amazing in that they've found 166 different fossilized species, like they've identified.
Wow.
So there could still be more.
Yeah.
And basically what it was is like 11, 12 million years ago, it was a forest river landscape.
Mm.
And so what this meant is it had a whole bunch of what you call different ecological niches.
Yes,
so
right.
Different sort of ways that animals could live. And so it was really biodiverse. And
yeah,
so they have
right.
things like, well, they said they had like tiny weasel-like animals that are less than a kilo, up to large hyenas and saber-tooths. You know, you had your meat eaters, your fish eaters, your bone eaters.
Little zoo in there, basically. Yeah,
yeah, and like they were saying, it's kind of amazing, not just from a historical perspective, like looking at the fossil record and seeing how biodiverse it was, but even now on our planet, you'd be struggling to find somewhere that there's this biodiverse.
Yeah, just zoos, in fact, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, like it's, and this is one of the really important things about still studying fossils and looking at past times, because, you know, by looking at this biodiversity in areas and what's happened with time, we can start to also better understand what, you know, with climate changing and stuff, what might happen to the animal environment.
And as things change, you know, we see the pandas maybe go to eat bamboo. Who knows? Maybe we'll see lions in the future herbivore. Maybe not.
It'll be interesting.
Yeah.
We might not recognise them as lions anymore. But
yeah, that's true. Maybe we'll call them something like Beatrix or something else there. And then this second story really blowing my mind. I wasn't sure what to think of it. Was it using light to spot COVID? What?
So it's kind of an interesting one, this one, in that it was more using the light to concentrate the viruses to then spot the COVID. And whether that was still using light, it could still use light, but not necessarily have to. So,
right.
I mean, we all know more about viruses than we ever thought we would before 2019, right?
Like, I couldn't tell you anything about a virus in 2019.
Yeah, you know, right? And now we know things like there's the spike proteins on the surface of viruses, and those mutate, and so you get lots of variants, and so you keep having lockdowns because your pandemic keeps going. We know, you know, viral load, so how much you need to start seeing your symptoms. You need to have so many copies of the virus in your body, sort of thing, and that's your viral load. And we've all become very familiar with the lateral flow tests, which were those were your rat tests, right?
Yep.
Where, you know, they were very rapid. You know, we were doing them at home, but then the sensitivity maybe wasn't so great. So, you know, like one day you'd be feeling fine, the next day maybe a little bit not so great. You'd take your rat test, and the day you're feeling fine, you see nothing. The next day,
And seeing positive line.
Yeah, you know, so this has been one of the tricky things with when you're trying to test for a virus, is they are tricky. They're really small, right? So you they're basically nanoparticles. They're like on the 100 nanometer sort of range. SARS-CoV-2 is on the 100 nanometer range. There is a bit of variation across different viruses. And then there's that concept of viral load. So how much do you actually have in your body before you start seeing symptoms? And if you want to see it before you want to tell if someone has it before you start seeing symptoms, you know, you need a really sensitive test.
That makes sense.
Yeah, you know, and so in when they did a lot of the, like, tracking of the different variants of COVID, often that test happened in the lab and they would have to do amplification. So they would have polymerized chain reaction to amplify the DNA and then do their test. But if you were wanting to, like, have a quick test and you want to avoid having to amplify and taking a long time, maybe one of the ways you can solve the problem is you concentrate what viruses you do have, viral particles you do have, into a small area.
Bit of a forcing them all into one spot, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Exactly, right? Got You're it. Concentrating. And so that's what this study was about. So they had a surface that was nanostructured. So it basically had these little nanoballs. So we're about 500 nanometers across these little bowls. And you could actually coat it with antibodies. So the things that would bind to the spike protein.
Yep.
On the COVID.
Essentially a glue bowl.
Yeah, basically a glue bowl. Got it. But then if you still got only a small amount of bio fluid, because, you know, like often if we're thinking about we want to use like our saliva or something, we don't have litres of it.
Right? No. We've got small amounts. Very small amount. Yeah.
So we want to use small amounts. And so what they were doing is basically from a small volume on the surface, then they would shine like a laser at it, but it was like really low power, like 5 milliwatts. You kind of think a laser pointer. And what this does is it causes really small amount of localized heating, which generates bubbles. And what happens is with those bubbles in the fluid, you start to get these convection currents.
Yep.
And so it basically brings in these nanoparticles or our virus particles into a very small localized area that's just under the edges of the bubbles. And so it concentrates it. And so then now you can start just looking at that little area and start do your sensing.
Yeah. And that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of an interesting one in that it kind of reminds us that we're still developing new methods to try and test for viruses.
Yeah. Especially at the start, right? COVID tests, they were developing quite quickly, right?
Yes, exactly, right? And so we came quite far quite quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, there would have been a lot of work done before the pandemic, so we were building on stuff that was already had already been happening anyway, and it just kind of got accelerated. But now there's still a lot of work going on, and it'll be interesting to see in like 5-10 years' time if we're still doing the rat test the same way or
maybe
not.
Shine a laser pointer on the rat test in your home. That'd be crazy. And then this last one absolutely blew my mind. I've written here separating liquids with liquids. That's not quite what's happening.
So this one, it caught my eye because it's about porous liquids, and I've never heard of a porous liquid.
What is a porous liquid?
Before.
Yeah.
So it's essentially, it's a something that's a material that's liquid at room temperature, but it has permanent cavities. So if we think of solids, we can see how they're porous, right?
Yeah, like sponge, right?
Exactly.
Has holes in it. It's very obviously porous.
So how on a liquid, like how does this work? And it's this idea that there's three different types. And so it's basically type one is where it's just a liquid itself, but whatever the molecule is that makes up the liquid has a structure that means that it has pores to it.
Right.
That one, I find that one the hardest to kind of imagine.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, but whereas the other two types are a little bit easier to understand, where you actually have, there's a rigid host or a particle that is itself microporous that is dispersed in a solvent. So the solvent's a liquid part. But whatever that solvent is can't actually enter into those pores. And so that's where you get this porous
nature. Same with like a water oil type situation.
Yeah, except so in that case you're kind of thinking that the oil beads or bubbles, not bubbles, balls
drops,
kind of thing, drops.
Yeah.
That this would be now your particle that's got these micropores in this and that. And so that's what this concept of porous liquid is, and why it's kind of important is that, you know, if we think about, there's a lot of stuff about capturing gas, right?
Yep.
CO2. We want to capture the CO2 out of the atmosphere and limit our climate change problems. And so often this involves solids. But solids obviously can be hard to work with on like an industrial scale. Whereas if you've got a fluid, something that you can pump, and it's, you know, sequestering gas, then this might have quite some advantages.
Yeah, very easy to move around.
Yeah, exactly, right. And so this is what most of the work on this, the application of these porous liquids most of the research has been looking at is to do with gas and gas capture. But what this group did was they went, well, what about if we used it in a liquid system? So you get liquid mixtures where you want to extract one of the things and not the other. So if we think about miscible solutions, so ethanol and water, you know, they mix well.
Yeah.
And if we want to separate them, we have to use processes like distillation, which you're heating up.
Takes ages, yeah.
And it's energy, right? Mm. And so this is what this group was interested in. Could you use these porous liquids to actually separate out liquids, do a liquid separation? And so they looked at ethanol water mixtures, and they also looked at a mixture of what's called monoethylene glycol in water.
Mm.
Now, why they were interested in this monoethylene glycol is it turns out that we use a lot of it. So in 2022, globally, 31.93 million tons of this were used.
In what?
It's a de-icer.
Right.
So the aviation industry or aeronautical industry uses it a lot to de-ice, I guess, runways and planes.
Runways, planes, windscreens, that sort of thing.
And so what you end up with is a lot of this, it's in a water mixture, right?
Yep.
So it's the monoethylene glycol in the water, and it's not environmentally friendly. So you'd end up with big tanks of it that need to be treated to separate out the two.
That makes sense.
And often it's distillation. So that's a very energy hungry process. And so they were interested in, could they develop a porous liquid to basically separate out these two? And they, to some degree, yes, they did. So they were using what was called a zinc metal organic framework as their microporous particle. And they were putting it in sesame oil or polydimethyl siloxane. And they were able to separate out some of this monoethylene glycol from the water.
Mm.
It was very minimal, like it was only like 2% difference. They were using like 88% of their pore volume though. So they were kind of going, yes, it's working quite well, but we need to better understand how it's working, like get better at getting the hydrophobicity balance right. So that's how water loving your
make
parts
it more
of your system
porous.
And get it more porous. Yeah. And so these things. They did also try it on ethanol and water, and then they applied it to some wine and some gin as well, because as we all know, there's a lot of non-alcoholic beverages coming into the market, but it's really hard to remove the ethanol from those from gins and wines and stuff.
Yeah, right. It's such a key component.
Yeah, and keep the flavor profile, right? Because a lot of the methods that you're using to remove the alcohol is also doing something to those volatiles or those flavor compounds as well. And so they didn't do any taste testing. They only wanted to see if they could remove the ethanol. But
was it effective?
Again, only about like 2% sort of thing. So, but they see it as it's at least showing that they could do it and that they can further develop it. So this was the first time.
Yeah, that's really interesting stuff. Also porous liquids, right? Proving that water maybe can be wet.
Yeah.
Right? Or even more wet water.
It's
bit of a mind-boggling one there.
It is, really.
Yeah, all right. Something to think about. Chew on some thoughts as you chew on your lunch during the show. Thank you, Kushla, for coming in once again. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.